You're listening to Son of a Pitch. How's it going, ladies and gentlemen? Another exciting episode of Son of a Pitch. Michael Kawaika, it's a late night edition, early morning edition. We're going global. We're doing all kinds of earth rotations and miscellaneousness. We're fucking with time zones tonight, my friends. And joining me today to fuck with said time zones is the one, the only, the Troy McCann, founder of Moonshot Space Company in Sydney, Australia, and a good, hopefully burgeoning bromanship taking the reins. But Troy, welcome to Son of a Pitch. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Michael. This is really exciting.
I can feel it. I can feel the excitement.
Feel it, the energy. Let's talk about space.
There's some tingliness in the air. Let's talk about space. Let's talk about why the fuck space is. Why should we talk about space, Troy? Tell me.
Well, I mean, so this can get way. I can go down the rabbit hole real quickly. So just stop me if I start to go down a deep.
Rabbits are our most avid listeners.
Yeah. Well space rabbit holes are even.
Well, what got you started in space?
Let's go right back, and I'll try to avoid telling the full life story, but it has to be, because I've loved space ever since I was a kid, because who doesn't, who hadn't? But being an Aussie and growing up in Australia, we never had a space agency or anything like that. And so from the beginning, I always knew that I'd never be able to do anything. Well, I believed that I knew that I'd never be able to do anything in space. It was always going to be this cool thing. And for me, I just love the technology of it. I love the opportunity, all of that kind of thing, space really meant. And I saw technology as this thing. It was like being a wizard if you could be an engineer and being able to put things together to write.
I mean, being so close to New Zealand, you've certainly heard of your fair share of wizards and hobbits and shit, right?
Oh, yeah. I can't wait. I should be going on a trip to New Zealand later this year to go and visit all of the Lord of the Rings locations and things. I haven't done it yet. It's so close, but haven't been able to do it yet.
Have you done the Matrix tour? I know a lot of it was shot in Sydney. I've done that myself.
I don't know if there's a specific tour. So one of the buildings, one of the main buildings that they use is actually just a government building. So I go there all the time for meetings and things. But there is a abandoned or semi-abandoned power station, a really old power station near where my partner's parents live. And a couple of years ago, Google were actually going to buy it and turn it into this big tech precinct. And apparently I found out that there's still the set of part of the Matrix inside the building all these years later. It's really cool. I want to find a reason to get in there one day, but hopefully they don't tear it down soon. It's really funny, actually.
You've been piqued by technology from a young age.
Oh yeah, I just absolutely loved it. I fell in love with it. I loved everything about it. So I taught myself how to write code when I was really, really young. I loved pulling. I remember my mother's probably still got a collection of remote controls and electronics and VCRs and things. I just pulled them apart, try to work out everything worked. I loved working everything about how computers work. I'd reformat them, install DOS and Windows. When I was five. But I never thought that I could do anything in space. So I had little spaceship toys and things like that. And so when I got to uni so I did computer science and then transferred into electrical electronics engineering. And I had no idea what I was supposed to do in Australia, because we dig holes in the ground. So I could have gone and been an electrical engineer doing on mining sites. Yeah. But for me, it just wasn't really I just didn't find that quite interesting. And I just didn't know what I wanted to do. So I spent most of my time building race cars as part of Formula SAE, and that was really cool. So I got to do some early autonomous vehicle kind of
fucking right
research and things like this, playing with sensors on cars and all this sort of stuff.
So you had your opportunity to geek out a little bit, hey?
Oh, I geeked out plenty. That's my whole life, is just getting to just finding ways to geek out. That's really all it is. And then in my last year of university, discovered CubeSats. So, these little satellites that you're made from the same components as your smartphone. So because of smartphones, the components are really powerful, but really cheap. The smartphone created this digital chip revolution that has really enabled the space industry to take off at the moment. And so I was saying,
pun intended.
I told you before,
the space industry. We've got to ignore the space
puns. There's too many space puns.
So the guy who founded Moonshot.
should write a book of just space puns, but it's just the English language has so many. I don't know what we did before the 1950s because there must have been zero puns. It's just, I guess,
brain should be like a tiny book that just gets sent up in every space shuttle for the lavatory. So you just get to read like space puns while on the space can attached to that vacuum. Like anal vacuum.
Oh, it was just yesterday. I was watching the video about how the space toilet works on the ISS again yesterday. I was like, oh, it's not my thing. I'm sure we can come up with something better when we get to Mars.
Stay tuned for next episode of Son of a Bitch, where we discuss space toilets and how suction can really help.
Discovered CubeSats, and so I got together with a group of mates and we said, hey, like, let's try to build a satellite. And then quickly realized that the engineering side was actually the easiest part. We had to get a launch license, like a space license, to launch this thing from our government, and we don't have any space stuff. And we had a look and there was some laws and it was really archaic. We had to have a satellite that would have cost us about $2,000 to build, $100,000 eventually to launch it. We would have had to have got $850 or $750 million of insurance coverage. So it's just all these archaic laws. So we ended up building like this.
That's like
this
a really overpriced FedEx bill.
It was ridiculous. Like, the insurance was like by far the most expensive thing.
Can't you just if they sent Felix Baumgartner, if Red Bull can haul that dude all the way up to the edge of space and then he just peace out. Couldn't you have been Red Bull, can we do that again? But just instead of Felix in there, shoot shit up. Like, who's going to stop?
We considered that. We actually did strongly consider that. But unfortunately, the way that the space law, because space law is a thing, the way that that works is that every nation sort of basically has agreed. So there's this thing called this Outer Space Treaty, and it's actually got a really, really profound long name that I can never remember. It's like the Treaty of Celestial Bodies and peace in outer space. And I can never remember it.
It's kind of really like Antarctica and stuff, eh?
Yeah, but even more like
no man's land. Well, obviously more, just a little bit more vast.
Well, there's a lot. It feels a lot more philosophical when you start reading it, because it's really looking into the future, but because it's from 1967. And so all the countries around the world have basically agreed to, okay, this is how we're going to use outer space. And so if a Russian satellite crashes into an Australian satellite, what happens in that case? And so all the nations have said, well, we will take responsibility for our own, satellites and stuff belonging to our citizens and corporations and things. They never really foresaw that we were going to have this private space industry. And so the Australian government, as every government around the world does, says, well, look, if you are an Australian citizen, you want to launch a satellite, you have to apply for a license from us, because if you do anything wrong, then we get in trouble. The Commonwealth of Australia gets in trouble for it. So that's why there's all this stuff. Yeah. So we, as this group of students at the University of Melbourne,
slapping on Russia stickers on the back of the thing.
Yeah, just be like, it's not ours. It's not ours. I don't know what Americans do
when they travel and put a Canadian flag on it, and no one will be the wiser.
it'll be fine. Well, we do that with the Kiwis. So, we're building the satellite, and that was really cool. And for me, I was looking at it, I'm like, well, it's just an embedded system, and we just got to it's just going to be a little bit further away. We had this old Bureau of Meteorology satellite dish thing that was used for weather in the 60s, and we repurposed it to talk to the satellite. But the biggest challenge was we had to build a team of space lawyers. So we went to the law school and said, who wants to do space stuff? And of course, all these lawyers put their hand up, said, well, I'm not great at maths and physics, but I can do a lot of legal things. So we ended up getting invited to go to Parliament House in Canberra and advising the government on what we need to do for space. And so
was there already a space law program? And
well, no. So it was all new. So this is only a handful of years ago.
Shit up as you go along, eh?
Basically, yeah. So we got to advise them, and so now a few years later, we've got an Australian space agency. We're developing a space program. But that was my start. That's how I got started.
Kind of glossed over I was designing these really autonomous vehicles and everything, and then I'm like, CubeSats. Was it just literally Tuesday was autonomous racing vehicles and Thursday was I took a runny dump and read something in Popular Mechanics about CubeSats, and then there we go.
So
or was it some kind of a moment? Holy fuck, this is something I need to be in.
So at the time, I thought that it was because it was this new thing. I hadn't heard of CubeSats before that and just sort of discovered and said, like, well, there's high school kids doing it across the world. So surely, like, we as, you know, as electrical engineering students should be able to do it. You'd hope. And luckily, so the part that I glossed over is we did launch it. It is in space, and that was all good. So we convinced the university to give us $270,000, and we ended up buying the launch and getting every, you know, we got permission to have that insurance thing, like, basically waived
like
by the minister.
Like $450,000 in, you know, normal rest of world dollars, right? Like $4.75.
Yeah. About that. With you. So when I was doing the race car, one of the cool things, so this is, I think, a subconscious thing. I really wanted to build all of my electrical systems to the highest standards that I could. And so I ended up finding a bunch of aerospace sponsors. And so I was actually building my race car next to like F-35 Joint Strike Fighter components being manufactured and produced. And I got to build them to like some military specifications. And I sort of think that that was, because that was around about the same time that I started.
I mean, Rolls-Royce and Bentley and stuff all started as, Saab started as jet engines and stuff.
Well, that's it. And so when you're talking about like, you know, top end motorsport as well, all of the engineering, it's basically the same as, you know, as aerospace.
Yeah.
It's all
you're
the same.
Drag coefficients, you're talking, you know, all other fancy names and words I don't know. All these kinds of fucking cool. But was there like, so were you always, maybe there's one thing that I noticed when you were just saying is that there was this, you mentioned that you always wanted to build it to the highest specifications. Mm. Why?
Yeah, look, that's a good question. For me, I'm a maker. I like building things. I like getting my hands dirty. I love building the technology. I describe it, like I said earlier, it's like being a wizard. If you can just like build these things and people look at them like, how does that work? Like that I find amazing. That
so
is
the
magic.
Space, what's the coolest thing you've made that you currently use?
Ooh. Well, I think the coolest thing that I contributed to eventually, because we had a whole bunch of people that helped build the satellite. I think the coolest thing by far is that satellite. And all it does, it's so simple. Like, you know, it's really basic compared to a lot of satellites out there. Like we really didn't build it. We thought it was kind of like flipping a coin. There was so much more testing we could have done. And we really didn't know what we were doing. And so all it says, like it just beeps. It beeps a message and it says, you know, if found, please return to the Melbourne Space Program. And that's all it does. So to some extent, I kind of wish that we had pushed a little bit further.
But I'm glad that we are here kind of situation, like a if lost, find, please return to owner.
Yeah, that's it.
You basically sent out a wallet.
Basically. Well, yeah. At one point we considered making it a like a Bitcoin node and things like this, but we kept it simple. So the Melbourne Space Program is still going now. So I'm still an advisor in it, but handed over the baton. So the same time that I started the space program is where I sort of literally the same month, November 2014, I transitioned from being just this person who like to sit in a room on my own and building cool technology to, there's this thing called entrepreneurship. And like I can have a company that helps me get these products into the hands of more people. And that's because a friend of mine came to me and said, hey, you can do electronics. Can you help me make this thing that I already sell, an internet connected device? And so then that sort of snowballed into a bigger company where I worked with universities in Victoria and local SMEs to basically commercialize deep tech research. So a lot of electronics products, we did a lot of medical products. So if you're in Florida, in Orlando at the Florida Mall, the interactive children's playground there, that was our design. We designed that. It was really cool. So there's a whole lot of like, you know, electromagnetic sensors and things like this. Like it was really cool to build.
Really random reference.
Yeah, very
like
random.
Playground in Florida, in like America's elbow.
I know. So I was in Florida a couple of years ago and I was sort of sitting at the airport.
Did you go visit like, your playground?
Well, I did because I totally had, I'd just forgotten that it was even there because we built this thing in like 7 weeks or so. And it was one of the most stressful projects I ever worked on, but,
playgrounds and then stressful locations that kids have to endure. Yeah. I can see that.
Now you
pumped it full of sensors.
Well, yeah, there was so many sensors and I won't go into that project. It was honestly one of the most difficult, engineering projects, not for the engineering.
But you discovered entrepreneurship somewhere along the way. So through the chaos of this stuff, you'd found out about this concept, this thing, this being of entrepreneurship, and that must have catalyzed some. Did it catalyze anything? Was it a Was no, that totally the discovery did. Of Trigger? How did you discover, how did you learn about entrepreneurship? Because you were doing your engineering practice. Thing. You were taking shit apart. You were fucking
yeah.
practice.
So, I look at what, the way that I, like my philosophy around entrepreneurship is, you know, you build, you, like especially tech entrepreneurship, you build the technology. Like that's one thing. That's right. engineering. I still right. take an engineering approach to say, well, the business itself has to be, it's a system. You have to say, all right, how do I take a dollar in and how do I get you know, at least you know, $1 and 1 cent out? Ideally more. And so that business model is just an extension of the tech product you're trying to design. And then when you think about things like venture capital or bootstrapping and, you know, and that sort of system of, well, how do we encourage the growth of more of these kind of tech products and services and companies? That itself is just sort of another layer on top of that engineering problem as far as I'm concerned. So I sort of just fell into this rabbit hole of trying to understand that more and more. I had a medical device company that spun off for a little while as well and was doing all this space stuff on the side as a hobby. Eventually said, hey, I love doing the space stuff, but it's just a hobby. I've got to focus on these companies now that I'm running. And so 2 weeks later, after leaving the Melbourne space program, Buzz Aldrin came to Melbourne of all places in the world to do called Mars Live Experience with National Geographic. They were doing this really cool, like semi like stage show with a bit of like really cool, like film stuff in the background.
Shooting out in a rocket and stuff. Like
it was just cool. Basically, before. Like it was just Buzz saying like, hey, we need to go to Mars. Like this is what we need to do. And just selling the whole thing. So I was really lucky and got invited to go to this like VIP function beforehand. And the whole idea, like people paid like $800 for a ticket to go to this thing. So I was like, all right, I'm just a kid. I got nothing worth like Buzz hearing that I have nothing to say to Buzz really. So I'm just going to leave him alone. I'm just going to stand back, just appreciate the moment and let everybody else sort of hover around him and you know, give him all the attention that I'm sure he's not over after half a century of having that. Anyway, so it turned out that Buzz was late.
You take one walk. You go for one walk and then nobody will leave you alone.
Just bombarded, just the paparazzi. Yeah.
Jesus. Never run like relentless. These motherfuckers.
It's horrible. It's horrible.
Did you meet him?
I'm joking. I don't know. I have no idea what that feels like. But so Buzz Kate did come out and he was talking and he spoke for about 30 seconds because he had to get ready to get on stage. It was a little bit late. So everyone was disappointed. And a friend of mine who her name's Angie, she works for the European Space Agency, but she's an Aussie, dual citizen, Aussie and Italian. She'd come back to Australia to help set up our space agency. And she was like, Troy, she's like, turn around. I want to get a photo with you and Buzz. I'm like, well, Buzz is like 20 meters away from us. And there's like a whole crowd of people in front. And just so I'm like,
your arms around him from like that far.
Yeah, just stretch them right out.
Right.
So there's this awkward photo that with all these people in front, I'm kind of like, do I even smile? Like what is this picture? Anyway, I don't know if she planned it this way because as Buzz finished and him and his security entourage, like sort of were disappearing, the crowd was dispersing. And as I was turning back around, all of a sudden Angie shoves me in the back and I sort of like experienced some whiplash. Before I knew what was going on, she pushes me a second time. She's like, Troy, go, just get in there. So I have no idea what's going on. And all of a sudden we're like rushing down this corridor surrounded by Buzz and his security entourage. And one of the security guards turns and says, hey, like, who are you guys? And Angie just really casually is like, no, it's all right. Don't worry. Like, he's with me. It's all good. And he's just, oh, okay. And so we get to the end of the corridor and it's a little bit frantic because they really needed to get Buzz ready to get on stage. So someone's like frantically pressing this elevator button, waiting for the elevator to come. A couple of people start to be a little bit concerned that there's two strange people here. Someone says like, who are you and what do you want? Angie's calling out to Buzz being like, Buzz, Buzz, Buzz. I really just want to introduce you to a good friend of mine, Troy. And someone else says, no, there's no time. And another person again just says, just get in the elevator. And the next minute, like I'm literally being pushed, like shoveled into the elevator with Buzz Aldrin, where suddenly I found myself having to give a literal elevator pitch, not even between a whole floor, it's to a mezzanine level with an Apollo 11 astronaut. Which was probably the most surreal moment of my life where I do not.
I'm just mildly concerned about Buzz's security detail.
Yeah, you would think like, it would be a little
no
bit.
No one. That, yeah, seriously. You'd think that there'd be a little bit of.
I guess we were in the VIP section, but
oh, don't worry. He's with me.
Don't worry.
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay, that's all good. That's all good.
Kid. Yeah.
Yeah. This is just the guy that, you know, after visiting us, he went down and, you know, I think he got the world record for being the oldest person to successfully visit the South Pole. That was like a week later after I had this experience.
Holy shit.
Like he's amazing.
Just collecting records.
Yeah, it's not fair. So like, leave some for the rest of us.
Did meeting Buzz change anything for you?
So it did. So I didn't realize it at the time. So, by the way, I got a second awkward photo. So I don't remember really what I spoke to him about. I know what I must have spoken to him about, which is like my philosophy around this whole idea of, you know, the average person can now can access space. So we were just right. some students. So we had just, for the fraction of a cost of an investment property, just launched a successful satellite. Imagine if that had a commercial value. Like, so it's so accessible now. And so I saw all this. So I explained all of this to him, and I thought, he doesn't care about this, and that's fine. I appreciate that. There's this awkward moment where I was like,
lost and found beacon.
This is the moment where I'm like, Troy, stop talking. Just leave it. Like, just have a break. And so Buzz is just staring at his feet, and we're stuck in this tiny little steel box together. And I'm just like, someone please put us out of our misery. Open the
door.
Like,
someone cut the cord now. Yeah.
So the door opens, and then the first, like, this awkward photo was taken by his marketing person. And I'm trying, you know, when you're so anxious that you can't control it, you're trying to smile and you just can't. So I've got one of those photos where Buzz is there, and he's like, but as the door's open, he looks up and he's like, that's fantastic. He's like, you have to meet my son, Andy. He's in Florida building a school for space entrepreneurship. And then he spends the next sort of 5-10 minutes beating away the people trying to get him to get ready to get on stage, because he just wanted to talk to me about space entrepreneurship. So he did get me in touch with his son, and so they became investors. And you know Andy now. You've had a chat with him.
I'm going to be having a chat with Andy this week, next week, sometime, one of these days. We've connected.
Fantastic, yeah. He's amazing. So he's been on Moonshot's advisory board since the beginning. And it was a conversation with him that I really understood, like, the problems that I saw about, like, how do we help more space startups? Because people know how to build software, and there's all this like framework around it. Investors understand software and SaaS companies, but when it comes to space, we still think of it as this intangible, impossible location that nobody can access, and it's really expensive. And so people just turn off. Like, even if they really love space as a concept, like sci-fi, so,
like, hard to believe,
it just seems unbelievable.
Or just,
and even
they think you're bullshitting.
Yeah, they just think, yeah, they're like, there's no way that this could be a real thing yet. But and even for those,
if we dial it back from like just the space conversation for a second, and think about just the. So there's this inherent sense of, like, as an engineer, you obviously seek to create some semblance of a solution set or an order out of the chaos. You build systems to encapsulate the systems within systems. Even your definition of entrepreneurship is itself. Yep. It's a new system that I need to figure out.
Feedback loops and
I mean, but at what point, like, there has to have been a moment in your life where there's this Beatles track, you know, I think it's Good Day Sunshine, where at the beginning there's this crescendo. And then it cuts out and then goes into like this drum beat, if you will, or the piano beat.
Yeah.
You know, I woke up, got out of bed, started doing like routine stuff. Which point did you switch from holy fucking shit, what's going on? I don't know what I'm doing. This is cool. Like, when did you, like, there had to have been a moment where you looked at Troy and said, well, what the fuck does Troy really want? You didn't just graduate uni and then jump on the slip and slide of fucking life.
Everything for me, like, everything was by accident. Like, I haven't planned anything. I've just keep tripping into these things. And as in, like, I've never sat down and said, okay, cool, I'm going to build race cars. Like, okay, cool. After that, I'm going to build a satellite. You know, I'm going to put together this group together. Okay. After that, I'm going to start a company called Moon. Like, no, like that, like, I never planned these things. So I think for me, it was about 2 weeks later that I came up with the name Moonshot, and I had this realization that conversation I had with Buzz was actually my pitch for Moonshot, where I was like, hey, like, this is like that. Like, I didn't realize at the time that I was in the elevator with him, as much as you would expect that to be such a profound moment in time. It just took a couple of weeks for that to really percolate and really sort of to hit me. And I'm trying to avoid the pun, the gravity of the situation, but I have to mention it. And so it was about 2 weeks later, and I was like, okay, I don't know what Moonshot's going to do, but I know that is, like, that's the problem that it has to solve. It has to help more people understand how to leverage these frontier locations, because space is, like, isn't just this homogeneous location that's everything else outside of the planet. Especially, like, you know, I think most people are so used to seeing the Earth from this, like, from the perspective that they are, right? And we forget that like the Earth is really just this infinitesimal speck on this backdrop of this huge universe where, you know, the moon is a different location. Earth orbit is entirely different again. Mars is different.
You mentioned frontier.
Mm.
The concept of frontier spaces.
Yeah.
Which itself lends itself quite nicely to the notion of systems within systems, boundaries encompassing systems. What has the notion of being on the frontier of stuff, is that something that's become an important driver for you?
For me personally? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah, totally. I think for me, I've roughly got 82 years like on this planet, and I'm already through a significant chunk of those. For me, I don't want to spend my time doing things that aren't in the frontier. Like, you know, for me, I'm like, well, why do things? And this is for me, I don't know, this is not for everybody, but
this is the person I'm talking to.
Yeah. Why should I spend time on things? It's just sort of, you know, just keeping things chugging along just within like what we've already got.
Lots of people have good reasons for that, you know, but why did you choose this frontier pursuit? This like standing on the precipice of known and unknown, of structure and chaos, of the abyss and certainty.
I just find it's exciting. It's what excites me. I think it's like, yeah, it's very similar to if you ask an explorer, like, why do you explore? Like, why do you want to go discover new places? Now I don't know I don't think I will ever be work in a job where I'm an astronaut specifically, like, you know, discovering these locations myself. I think I'll always be on it'd be really cool. I do want to get into space. Like that would be amazing. Like that'd be awesome. But I'm not the kind of person like, you know, I don't, for me, like I wouldn't want to go and live on Mars for the rest of my life, for example. That's not my thing. If I could come back and if, you know, the more thing, I will help you build like the most amazing city in turn, you know, locations in on Mars.
So you do a year in Mars.
I'll do a gap year. Yeah. You know? Yeah. That'd be right.
Like some people travel the world. Other people are like, well, fuck it. Let's just go see what Mars is up to.
Well, I've traveled the world now. So, well, this is an interesting thing as well. Before Moonshot, I never considered that I would. So I'd never really been overseas at all.
Oh, for real.
Yeah. So I got to go to Japan like for a couple of weeks in high school, and that was really, really cool. But really, I'd never traveled. I'd barely been interstate, like even like from like away from Melbourne. I just didn't think it was possible for me to do anything more like around the world. And so a part of my driver was, well, there's so many people that are in that same situation that have these amazing ideas, amazing perspectives and problems that could be solved with these frontiers if only they had a little bit more access to resource and understanding that they could try to solve these problems using them. So I'm on this journey now to try to find like-minded explorers, I guess, in a way, like people who are saying, look, I want to take... Yeah. So resources from money to mentorship. Yeah. So it's intangible resources. It's access to
what I'm hearing from you and from what I've heard from other narratives. And I apologize to everyone that's listening. And this is probably one of the few times I'll mention this gentleman's name, but the Mr. Tony of Robbins has once mentioned, I saw in one of these shitty promo videos, that it's not a lack of resources, but a lack of resourcefulness that inhibits one's ability to explore and grow and change and develop. And so as poster-like as that might be, there might be some elements of truth to it.
Yeah. No, I agree. So my philosophy, I guess, would probably really extend on that a little bit. If you can help people see that they can be a little bit more resourceful or just show them like a small thing, then you should be able to unlock them to be, you know, it's kind of like teach a man to fish. If we can show people that they can be resourceful, if we can give them, say, you know, with our program, we've got this thing called the space elevator model where, you know, it's all about saying, look, if we give you 10 grand today, what can you do with that so that we can then give you the next 50, so that we can give you the next 2 million, so that we can give you the next 50 million or whatever it needs to be. So that, you know, and so it's all about saying, you know, how can you be resourceful within the means that you have and within the state that you're in at the moment? And then we'll be able to help elevate you through that process.
It kind of sounds like there's this, forgive me for like psychoanalyzing you as we're having this
quote unquote
chill chat, but like, it seems like this comfort in that duality of, and stop me if I'm wrong, the duality of chaos and order, systems and disorder and uncertainty. Because even within chaos, there's some element of statistics, probability, and likelihoods and stuff like that. You seem to gravitate towards these roles of, I don't want to say bridge builder, but it's almost like, you know how like you see these military videos where they build bridges out of nowhere? Or they bring these boats in and stuff like that. And you're like, how the fuck are they going to get that? Or like, or you look at these bridges and you're like, how the shit did that even happen? Like, there's from like point A to point Q, you have no idea how they got there. It seems like there's this trend in the things that you're describing, that your stuff that gravitates towards. Is there like a pull? Is there a deeper reason for why you feel the need to venture into the darkness to bring a flashlight and help people see, kind of thing? You're not fucking Moses. Yeah. This isn't like the second.
No, I know what you're getting at. Look, it's interesting. You know what I'm saying? I don't have. It's something that I ponder all the time. I think for me, like I've grown up through, like, there's always chaos around. And for me, especially in my adult life, I've sort of found ways to deal with that chaos and to turn it into order in a way. And so being
parents engineers too, or?
No, not at all. So I did get a lot of my engineering, I guess, encouragement from my dad, for example. But so he's a boilermaker, he's a tradie, and right, so on. he makes stuff, and so that's I picked that up from him. You know, when I was younger, we used to just weld things and stuff, make bookshelves and all that kind of thing. So that kind of like being able to just say I'm going to create things like that came from there. But he's not an engineer. My mother, she works in IT now, but that was after, like, because I worked in IT for a little while.
Oh, cool.
And so she was inspired. She, before I was born, she used to be a bookkeeper. Not anything like, the interesting thing is there was no entrepreneurship around me. There was no one that had even been to university, that was around. So I'm not really sure where all this stuff came from, but I was able to sort of manage all this chaos, and that's kind of sort of, it's analogous to technology as well, because like I said, if you're sitting in front of a software tool, like to develop software, and you're saying, okay, cool. Well, I've got all these keys on the keyboard. Now, how do I make this work of art? It's kind of like, if you've got a guitar and you're like, well, I've got all these, got all these strings and things. Now, how do I make a work of art from this? You've got all this chaos, and how do you start to order that in a way that's really beautiful to make some art? And so I guess, in my adult life, I started to work out, there's a bit of an analogy for that, and to be resourceful, to be able to do some really, really cool things and to show others that they can be resourceful too. And I think maybe I'm starting to psychoanalyze myself. This is probably quite dangerous on a recorded podcast. There was a point when I was about 21 or so, because I was never really social either. Like I'm not that great with social situations.
Well, engineers are notorious for their social skills.
Yeah, exactly. And then, so I was terrible. Like when I was younger, I was very much a loner. If you couldn't tell from what I described as what I used to do for fun when I was a kid. There was a point where I realized, actually, if I can only do so much myself. And if I can show other people that they can be a part of that, then we can leverage more people and we can get more people involved. And that too is, I guess, a bit of a systems thing, but that's also a really critical part of Moonshot. It's about saying, well, how do we bring together this amazing network of people who suddenly realize that they can be resourceful and they know what resources are available so that we can collaborate and create this rising tide. If we can have, people developing, amazing solutions. We haven't really ventured into some of the things that space can actually do for us today that we don't even really, that most people don't even acknowledge. But, so you just have to trust me that there's so much, space is really this, we've got the economy that's trying to expand into these new frontier locations. So everything that we do here on Earth today needs to be done in space. And everything that we do here on Earth today is underpinned by space technology somewhere now.
It's kind of akin to like the different revolutions of technology, to the explosion of people onto the, from bricks and mortar to the World Wide Web, to the forced transition that we've seen in the last couple of years to an even even greater usage of that kind of connectivity and network effects of technology, to like transposing and creating an entirely new economy, an entirely new ecosystem, if you will. That's just slightly beyond where we currently are. It's kind of like that, the one's grasp should only be, should be just beyond one's reach. Like the concepts that we have right now can be beacons towards what we can build into, you know, and I don't mean to overstep. I mean, you're the legend here, but it sounds also like, you know, maybe these things, from like songs to creating things out of the unknown, this notion of entrepreneurship that has evolved or mutated into a new space variant. This is, I mean, without channeling too much alien, too much predator here. Does it make sense for someone to like, what if some uni kid is listening to this right now? Like, does it make sense for them to start fucking with space tech?
Yeah, totally.
Why?
Totally. So,
like entrepreneurship aside, because that's already its own fucking bucket.
No, of course. Of course. So if you are the kind of person you want to like solve big, profound problems, I believe that space is really that next set of frontiers that we're going to be able to do that. So like sometimes I talk about this, this concept of, you know, the first Martian toilet, for example. So we were just talking earlier about this, you know, the toilet on the ISS, it's this highly customized thing, you know, a handcrafted toilet for space. Like it actually is. But if we're going to have,
I mean, you know, I would love that. Just like, hand, like that brings a whole new meaning to like when the tailor does the inseam kind of measurement.
Yeah.
Then you really get a proper measurement. You get that's properly fitted.
Well, it'd be interesting. I don't know how long that toilet's been on the ISS now, but I know that we've had what, roughly 630 or so astronauts, I think, that have used it in the last 20 years.
Filthy custom job right there.
Yeah, so it's a good toilet. So, but is it that custom if you've got that? Anyway, I won't go into it. Yeah. But so Martian toilet. So we know, roughly the economists say that if we are going to have a sustainable colony on Mars, it roughly has to be about 1 million people to have the economy that it will sustain it and all that kind of thing. So if we're going to have 1 million people, that means we're going to have, you know, a lot of toilets that we're manufacturing there. We're not going to be able to handcraft all of those. They're going to have to be mass manufacturable. Now, if we can develop those toilets and they're going to have to, like, you know, recycle all of the water, they're not going to be able to be plugged into a first world style, like sewage system. Like we have these great big networks in our first world cities. Yeah, you know, they're probably going to even, you know, have to like produce electricity and just try to like really optimize
what are the
every
Romans
little
done
bit
of- for us. Yeah. Well, aside from sewage and transportation and wine. What?
So if we can produce this toilet, that's all right. So if we can produce this toilet, this thing that we owe, you'd think it, you barely give it it wasn't a space one.
You wouldn't give a shit about.
I was going to say, you probably wouldn't give it two shits.
There you go. Now we're cooking.
I forget when I'm giving talks what kind of audience I'm talking to. So
the podcast is called Son of a Pitch, and you're talking to
that's
me.
That's true. That's true. All right.
There are zero holds barred on the shit jokes and fart jokes. There's
no censorship.
Feel free, man. Zero. I'm not hitting the bleep button. I might add good sounds.
All right. Let's go. All right. Troy Unleashed. So yeah, so if we're going to mass manufacture this toilet, we got to design this toilet. It has to be mass manufacturable.
We're still on toilets.
Well, we are. No. Okay. All right. Let me finish it up. So imagine what that means when we've got this toilet, the cost of manufacture is going to have to be relatively low. What does that mean for the billion or so people that are living in slums at the moment where they can't have first world sewage systems? They can't have toilets. And so because of that, they're subject to all this disease and disease that's around. They can't escape from it. Suddenly, if we're able to produce these toilets for Mars, that technology can come back and help us here on Earth. And that's a billion people that suddenly can be lifted away.
That's a
away.
Pretty hefty assumption, though.
No, it is. It is an assumption. And it's a very
there's going to be like a positive ancillary feedback loop. Like if they're already willing to spend millions just to send, you know, just to test rockets.
Yeah.
I mean, that alone would end world hunger or solve, obviously it wouldn't.
Well, so there is like, so the problem with, getting into dangerous territory here. The problem, and so I'm not saying that the world is unfair, and it sucks that I think no one's going to spend the money that we need to develop that kind of toilet today. Yeah. You got Bill Gates literally trying to do that.
A cool factor of sending it to Mars or something.
Well, that's the thing, but to go to Mars, and it's really unfortunate. It's just an alignment of interests. That's what these big powerful governments want. Exactly. But the great thing about it, I try to look at it as a glass half full approach. This is a great opportunity to develop some of those technologies. If we can live on Mars, Mars is if Earth had the most ridiculous climate change, we didn't change anything, and it literally turns into this barren wasteland where our oceans literally boil off. That's what happened to Mars a couple of billion years ago. If we can turn Mars into a place that we can live, we have solved a lot of the problems that we face here today. To me, venturing out into space, it's an opportunity to have new perspectives. So
minus the whole nuclear terraforming angle.
Oh, well, that's, yeah. I mean, so that's like, we're not going to, we should not nuke the poles of Mars.
We should not nuke Mars.
That would not work.
No more nukes.
If we can learn to live in these really inhospitable locations, these locations that are more inhospitable than anywhere on Earth, developing food, we're not going to be able to constantly send food between Earth and Mars forever. We shouldn't. It's going to be too expensive. Eventually, we're going to have to work out, how do we grow food in space? If we can grow food on Mars, we can grow it in the middle of the Sahara Desert. We should be able to do, we should be able to grow food, and food security should become really a non-existent issue at that point. So for me, space, it's about saying, look, we've got access to these frontier locations. They provide us with some economic opportunities to do some cool stuff. And the spin-off technologies and capabilities that we're going to be able to derive from getting to those locations and using them will be able to be used here on Earth to solve some of our greatest challenges in places that can't imagine.
Sounds like a revised kind of approach to space-based Maslow hierarchy of needs kind of thing, where you establish the core fundamentals of, safety, security, food, shelter, well-being, welfare, etc., until you reach the pinnacle of civilization. And frankly, just as in terms of a number from liberal economic theory, that you need something in the order of 5 to 10 million people to even establish an economic system. Silicon Valley only became Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley used to be known for fucking peaches entrepreneurs and stuff came in there and created this self-reinforcing cycle of you'll get Mars universities. You'll get with that critical mass of people, you'll get its own unique economies, its own unique exchanges and means of exchange. Because at the end of the day, what... Without risking going too deep into philosophy, what the fuck are we really? But sentient carbon forms.
Yeah, I agree, and that's really all we are. We're sentient, as far as we know. We're the only sentient beings in the universe.
At least we think we're the only sentient ones. Look at these motherfuckers.
So I don't think that we're the only ones. I think statistically, and it's hard, statistically is, we don't have the exact numbers to it, but looking at Fermi's paradox and things like this, there really should be life all throughout the universe. And of that life, there really should be sentient life as well. But even Isaac Asimov, for example, asked a really interesting question around, is there really anything special about sentience? Why do we sort of see that as the pinnacle? So there is that aspect to it. But as far as we know, we are the only sentient life form in the universe. And so what are we doing? And so for me, I think that that's a question that it doesn't necessarily have an answer, but it is profound. And I think it should create a drive for us to say, well, look, we should explore the universe. By getting access to these new locations, we get new perspective to solve our greatest challenges, to continue to explore, to understand. And I think, this idea that, we shouldn't spend money on going into space because we've got problems here on Earth. Well, I think that's sort of, it's like cutting your foot off, not even shooting your foot. It's like cutting your foot off to say, okay,
it is a tough argument to negate. I mean, one does not negate the other.
They are.
No, they're
mutually exclusive.
They're inherently the same. Yeah. I mean, at the moment, like, yeah, if it's because of climate change, for example, the way that we monitor climate change is through all of the Earth observation satellites that we have up there. Right. Like, that's the way that we monitor our environment. So space, like space technology, and that's literally that new perspective that we didn't have, you know, over half a century ago, that's allowing us to do that. Without these perspectives, we're stuck. We're going to secure ourselves in this, you know, in the world that we are at right now. So if we want to be able to improve our world, we have to say, well, we need to get different perspectives to look at these problems, to try to build new technologies, to try to work out, okay, are there better ways of collaborating and developing, new philosophies and new regulatory frameworks and on how, you know, what's it going to look like if we have nation states on Mars, or are we going to have like what comes after nations, for example? There's all these things that space allows us to start to consider, not in just this sci-fi thing, but because we're actually on the verge of getting there. So I really believe that we should try to venture out and explore, because if we don't, we're asking all these questions, but we're not actually even searching for the answers. And to go to space for me is about searching for those answers.
I guess that'll actually lead to a lot more questions. There's this comment actually you mentioned about getting new perspective. I was actually looking for it. There's this quote. Some dude was like, "I just wish you take the leaders of these warring worlds and bring them up and give them that perspective from the moon or from space and say, just fucking look at that, you bastard.
The overview effect. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's even in Carl Sagan's works, you know, with the pale blue dot, like all the wars you've fought, all the battles and all the quabbles over land and everything. John Locke said, you know, wars began the moment someone put a flag in the earth and said, this is mine. Yeah. You know, when you start defining that system, when you start naming those closed systems and not allowing any sort of outside inference and influence and interaction. But I mean, within that closed system, does that not also mean that you cannot preclude the presence of something beyond space?
Sorry, dive into that a little bit more.
Is space, fucking hell, I'm saying it. Is space the final frontier?
Ah. So.
Or is there like, are we on some kind of like pool table played by deities laughing at our follies? You know?
I mean, maybe. I mean, yeah. And yeah, we could dive into, if I wish we had another hour to dive into, what is a deity? And, you know, are we our own deities? Like, are we our own gods? Are we, So frontier in terms of like the next technological revolution, I believe it is. I'll start there because that's the easy one. I think that, you know, we've had the industrial revolutions, and like with the most recent one, like with, you know, we had, you know, the PC that led to the internet, that led to the web, that led to social media and things like this. It was all about saying, cool, we've got this new cyber frontier, and now we've got to try to work out how that perspective allows us to reimagine the world that we are in. And I think that that's what we've spent the time on over the last, you know, 2 to 3 decades in particular. And that's been really amazing. And now I think the pendulum's swinging back a little bit, where we're saying, hey, we've now like the economy's trying to push back like into new physical locations again. It's not just about that cyber frontier and that digital world. It's about saying, okay, how do we expand our perspectives in the physical world? And we've got things even in our current world, like, you know, autonomous vehicles. And I think, like, for me, the iPhone was the very first, like the start of that, where we said, okay, we're going to start developing hardware again. Silicon Valley went back and said, okay, we're going back to a little bit of hardware. And then that enabled us to sort of push software to that next level and to enable the next few things. So I think we're seeing the similar thing again. We're saying, look, we've got to go into Earth orbit. We're starting to look at the moon and Mars and things like that as well. And especially like with Earth orbit at the moment, this concept of digital twins, of which like the most famous one is Google Maps. We are getting all this data from space that are enabling us to create these digital models of our entire planet and how it operates. And that's augmented on top of our actual tangible physical world. And that is incredibly empowering for us in our economy and our society.
Yeah, and when you look at the research that Apple and Tesla are doing these days, that layering, that intense, almost, what's his name? Scoble actually calls them sugar cubes of information, where there are depths of layers within. So every, it becomes a three-dimensional pixel in space time, like a voxel, that you can actually get a, like, interact with and play around and be around. But does that, from a, from an entrepreneurship perspective, does that not mean that, do, like, how do you, how does an entrepreneur flourish in this next frontier? How does and being wary of the time, how do you,
of course,
how do you really capture that sense
I think
chaotic pursuit in an entrepreneur? How does, what's the next frontier as entrepreneur like?
I think it's not too dissimilar to the early entrepreneurs of the internet, or the early entrepreneurs of the first industrial revolution. It's about being able to consider what the future should look like that you want to create, like the better world, and then saying, okay, well, I've got access to these new locations. I've got access to these new resources and these insights that nobody else does. And I can, so I can envision this thing. Now I've got to go and create the technology and the business model and the things to show that, okay, there is value here to start.
So is space like the great reset button?
I don't think it's a reset. I think it's the next, you know, if our progress is a series of these, you know, of incremental S curves, I think that space is that next, you know, that real sort of sharp jump in that S curve.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Some people would say, you know, going to a different planet or whatever, that's the whole plan B kind of scenario.
So I don't like that at all. Sure. Like, it technically is a plan B. It's great to have your eggs in multiple baskets, but I see space. The opportunity is about saying, look, we're expanding our world. You know, once upon a time we had multiple worlds.
It's an extension to it.
Yeah. So our world is our economy, and it's expanding to encapsulate more locations in space, just as it's always done. And so it's not that we've got plan B. It's saying, like, no, we've got new locations to leverage. So in terms of the frontier, like, It is oversimplified to say, like, space is the next frontier, because it's like saying, well, the universe is a frontier, right? It's like, well, it's not. It's a set of all these things. The next frontier is, you know, is Earth orbit, and we've got the moon, and we've got Mars. Then, you know, and then we talk about, you know, over the next maybe, you know, 50 years or so, we'll venture out further, and we'll start to do, like, you know, the rest of the solar system, you know, moons of Saturn and things like this. And then things will plateau as they have over the last, you know, century. On our planet, as we took over the rest of the planet, and then eventually we'll find a way to get to, you know, the next stars and the planets that are around those, as we'll, we start
the belters.
And I'm thinking about The Expanse. I'm only on, like, episode 5 of season 1.
I can't get into it, man. My buddy was like, you gotta watch it.
It's been really tough, but the fact that everyone keeps saying, Troy, you've got to watch this, especially after I get to talk, I'm trying to persevere through it.
Like, I've tried to stay awake until season 3, but that's just, it's so painful.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so just to sort of pilfer through what we've covered, things like chance encounters with legends of space, the pursuit of order through some kind of self-made systems, structures, and making chaos seem manageable, helping people through the chaos and showing them that there are possibilities, bringing people together that never thought they should belong together, but rather, like the music you alluded to, end up coming together in some kind of twisted harmonic symphony of ideas and people and expansions, to the notion of space as the next giant S-curve leap in human expanse and exploration and development and self-discovery and everything. It sounds almost too good to be true. It sounds kind of out there. But something tells me you kind of dig being kind of out there.
You have to be out there. And like I said, I got into this because I worked with a team, put together a team, and we convinced the university to give us, you know, a couple $100,000, and we launched a satellite into space. So there is real opportunity here. I'm not just saying, hey, like, we should do all this stuff. And of course, that's just a small tip of the iceberg, but space is, it's a thing and it's happening. And people just aren't aware of it at the moment. So as profound and as big as
that kind of talk that was the same for the World Wide Web. That was the same for social media. That was the same for it's that sentence that this shit is happening. It's almost like in Game of Thrones. It's like, this will be unpleasant. You will not like it. You will not enjoy this, but it will happen. Kind of thing. That's and then, of course, you know, dragons ate them and shit like that or whatever. Yeah. Whatever.
So hopefully that's not going to happen.
Dragons, we're dragon safe. We've been dragon free for like a couple hundred thousand days or something. I think there's a sign next to McDonald's somewhere in Brisbane. But no, seriously, like this entire journey of where we as a species are headed towards and the stuff that you're exploring yourself with, either putting it up there yourself and, you know, backing up what you said you were going to do to working with these teams at Moonshot, these amazing mentors and people.
Which we didn't even go into.
No, exactly. Cause I wanted to learn about you. I wanted to learn about,
fantastic.
The kinds of cool shit that drives, like, how crazy do you have to fucking be to set this kind of shit up? Like, where do you literally have to be on the edge of fucking Looney Bin City kind of thing. Like I've seen,
I don't disagree with that. That's,
you know, possibility in the chaos of being one of the few that can parse that together and then have enough confidence and wherewithal to piece things that people wouldn't imagine going together, you know? Yeah. Fucking salt and vinegar chips. How the fuck did they come up with that? Yeah, I'm just kidding. Chips in Canada. That kind of stuff. It's really fucking cool. And I think the stuff you're doing is pretty rad, dude. And
no, thank you. Look, for me, to bring it full circle to a question that you asked me earlier, I couldn't, especially now that I've been introduced to it, you know, through the conversation with Buzz Aldrin and things like that. That was my, like, you know, that was that unlocking, you know, with a key. I couldn't see myself doing anything else now.
Right?
I couldn't see myself doing anything else. It's just so obvious to me. Yeah.
Well, Troy, thanks so much for taking time to chat with me / us / whoever's on the other end of this microphone, earphones, whatever.
This is really fun. Thank you.
This was pretty rad, dude. I said rad way too many times because it's late and I was a kid of the 80s. So fucking deal with
it. It's fine. You get a pass.
Thank you again for your, is there any way that people, if they want to reach out to you, if they want to connect with you, Moonshot or anything, how can we get involved? How can we get connected? How can we be a part of this next phase in?
Yeah, of course. So
humankind.
So easy way. So like we're on social media, find me on Twitter, Troy_McCann, Moonshots is Moonshot Space Co. So at Moonshot Space Co. We've got a newsletter, like just stay tuned. We're about to talk about some really cool stuff that we're doing with our investments and some really cool space companies. So, reach out.
Nice.
Cool.
Legendary, man. Well, thanks again. And I will see you real soon, skis.
Sounds good. Thanks, Michael. And ad astra.
Nice. And I think to myself.